This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The 2 million Native Americans living in the United States endured the highest poverty rate of any racial group in the country. Add to that high suicide rates, pervasive problems with alcohol and drugs, rape, and child abuse, all of which are more severe among the half of the population who live on reservations. And you have a painfully obvious crisis among North American Natives. What's less obvious are solutions. Some point to broken treaties that should be honored. Others toward racial stereotypes in American culture that ought to be banned. But Naomi Schaefer Riley says what Native Americans need are property rights. She's author of The New Trail of Tears, How Washington is Destroying American Indians, and wrote about property rights on reservations for The Atlantic. Naomi, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me.
So if you could summarize the laws that govern property on Native American reservations here in the U.S., what's the sort of status quo?
Right. So I think a lot of people don't really understand what a reservation is. A reservation means that the land is held in trust by the federal government. The only other people, by the way, that we hold things legally in trust for are children or the mentally incompetent. So I think it's actually pretty shameful that in the 21st century, this is the way we're talking about Indian lands. But what that means, in effect, is that if one Indian wanted to sell land on a reservation to another one, they would first have to get the permission of a bureaucrat from the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Washington. But the problems actually go much beyond that. If you wanted to, as an American Indian, get a mortgage on a reservation and you went to a bank, they would not give you one because you don't have the underlying title to the land. They would have no collateral, and they would not be able to foreclose on the property if you did not pay. In addition to that, of course, many Americans use the capital that they get from their land in order to start small businesses. They take out second mortgages or home equity loans, and American Indians don't have that access to capital that the rest of us have.
So everyday Americans enjoy these rights withheld from Native Americans. Why? What or who governs these rights? Is it old treaties?
No, it's actually it's the reservation system that was set up. And unfortunately, I think what people have failed to understand is while the reservation system was really set up as a way of pushing Indians out of the way and keeping sort of them in a controlled space while we pursued manifest destiny, now I think people have come to see reservations as almost a way of protecting Indians, as a way of ensuring that white people don't get their land, buy their land, or take their land from them. And we've kind of set it up as this idea that Indians on these reservations are living in some kind of, you know, socialist, environmentalist utopia that is kind of frozen in time. But during the interviews that I did across the country on different reservations, I found that, of course, this is not the way Indians want to live. They want the same freedoms the rest of us have.
Is that universal? I mean, I'm imagining that normalizing property rights could have a huge economic impact, but it would also remove the protections of setting aside land. You know, if land could be sold to non-natives, isn't there a risk of these areas being lost to tribes?
I think that, of course, one of the things you could do is you could sort of set aside these lands and say they will still be governed by the tribes. In the same way that if you, you know, had the city of Boston, one person sells land to somebody else in the city of Boston, it's still part of the city of Boston. It's just that individual owns it differently. And it's part of a system of property rights that is enforced by the government. But the problem is that this system really assumes that what Indians want is maybe to be farmers. I mean, a lot of the pieces, tracts of land that are owned are even too small to do anything useful with. So if you're an American Indian and you want to start up, you want to start a store, or you want to pursue a career, you know, that might require you to have money to put toward education, you don't have access for any of these things. And the result on the reservations is that there's almost no private sector. I visited one Indian reservation in Montana where the unemployment rate is 78%. A lot of people say, "Oh, you mean the employment rate?" No, no, no. I mean the unemployment rate. There are really no there's no private enterprise. All of the employment is done by the federal government or the tribal government, and people really can't pursue the things that they want to as individuals or as families.
Okay, so you mentioned the no right to buy, sell, have a mortgage. How about development projects? You just mentioned the Crow Reservation in Montana you visited, and there is government funding there for building a new veterans home. And of course, casinos have changed the economy for many tribes.
So, right, there is government funding for projects, and it just takes years and years and years for anything to get done because of the vast bureaucracy. I visited what was going to be a 15-bed veterans home that was going to cost $15 million. I mean, this is how much money it has taken to get through all of the different bureaucracies. There are 9,000 staff members at the Bureau of Indian Affairs. That's one for approximately every 110 American Indians on a reservation. And the American Indians themselves, you know, they refer to the BIA as bossing Indians around. They would really like Washington's bureaucracy off their backs. In terms of development, of course, Indian lands, while maybe in the 19th century were thought of sometimes as useless because they didn't have the proper soil for farming or raising cattle, a lot of them are hugely valuable now because they're sitting on top of coal or oil or resources that could be used for fracking if they wanted to. But the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Environmental Protection Agency combined to make it much more difficult for Indians to develop their land than for white people to develop theirs just a few steps off the reservation. One of the legislators I talked to said, "We are the most overregulated race on earth."
I'm speaking with Naomi Schaefer Riley. She's written a book called The New Trail of Tears, and it's about how Washington policy affects and governs American Indians. We're speaking specifically about U.S. law, which holds property rights in trust for Native Americans, and she says it's contributing to the grinding poverty among Native people. So the Indians that you spoke to, what do they envision? Tourism, mining, how would they do it differently?
Well, I think that they would do different things. I mean, different tribes would do different things, and different individual Indians would do different things. You have to come to understand that there's regulation both on what the tribes can do with public lands, but also what individuals could do with their lands. So I spoke to one man who was trying to buy a small piece of land from one of his neighbors to graze a few cattle on, and he and his neighbor had agreed on a price. And someone from the Bureau of Indian Affairs came in and said, "No, you can't sell it for that price because that's not fair market value." Now, of course, fair market value is, of course, what someone will give you for the land. It's not an artificial number that Washington comes up with. So those are sort of the two things. But to get back to your question, you mentioned casinos earlier. So those are tribal enterprises. And, you know, we do have to keep in mind that the number of actually successful casinos that have produced significant revenue is relatively small. I mean, we see them in the Northeast, you know, places like Connecticut. But most of the casinos that are in existence are really these kind of small, dinky affairs where there's no tourism. And so the only people who are actually at the casinos are reservation Indians themselves. So it's in that sense, it's not doing those tribes much good. But it's also actually had extremely harmful effects on some of the tribes that have even been successful. So I visited the Seneca Territory in upstate New York. Now, they've actually made $1 billion on their gaming revenues, both on their territory and at a casino in Buffalo as well. Unfortunately, the way that money gets distributed is in annuities. So when you turn 21 on the Seneca Reservation, on the Seneca Territory, someone sends you a check for more than $30,000. Now, up until that point, you've had a pretty dismal education because the schools that exist on the territory and just off the territory are pretty terrible. You may not have worked at all because the unemployment rate is so high. You've never saved or invested, and you have no idea what to do with this money. And many tribal officials acknowledge that a lot of it just gets spent on drugs and alcohol, sadly.
You just mentioned the school's inadequate education. Yet, looking at what you wrote about, $20,000 spent per pupil. Now, that's compared to a national average of $12,400. A lot of money, billions of dollars going into managing, subsidizing lives, subsidizing housing, subsidizing other economic developments, road maintenance, courts, agriculture, social services, health for Native American people here in the U.S. Why isn't it working?
Well, I think there are a number of different reasons. First of all, as I mentioned, you have just the vast bureaucracy that has overtaken this, and bureaucrats will always find something to do. They don't want to lose their jobs. And so one of the things that certainly happens is a lot of the money just ends up staying in Washington. The second problem is corruption. It's not true on every reservation, but certainly a lot of tribes suffer from this problem, and the money does not necessarily get to the people who need it. But then you just have the problem of government distribution of wealth. Like I said, there is no private sector. And so one of the results of that is that there is just an extraordinary amount of nepotism on these reservations. If you have a relative, an uncle, a cousin, perhaps, who's on the tribal council and you want to be the fourth grade teacher, it doesn't matter whether you're qualified or not. You have the connection, and you could be the fourth grade teacher. It similarly works the other way. If you, happen to have a student who is related to someone powerful in the tribe, and that student hasn't shown up to, 6 months worth of eighth grade, that eighth grade teacher, and I've interviewed some of these people, will be forced sometimes to pass that child, even if they're totally unqualified to go to the next grade, simply because of that family connection. So you can see how it is kind of, no matter how much money you pour into the system, if you've undermined the quality controls that are there, then there's really no way of ensuring success. I mean, American Indians have a 50% high school graduation rate, and that number is even lower for American Indians who just live on the reservation. Mm.
It just sounds like dismal conditions here in the U.S. And in Canada, there has been a push for legislation called the First Nations Property Ownership Act. Now, this would give them the legal framework for individual members to access capital, land rights. It's been described as, taking the feds out of the equation. What chance does the legislation have of passing?
Well, I think it actually has a pretty good chance. Right now, it's been a little bit sidetracked by some other Canadian Supreme Court decisions on Native and land rights. But I think there's actually widespread support for it. And one of the advantages that the legislation has is that tribes could opt in or out of it. If they don't want these property rights and they feel that this might, cause them some kind of, overturning of traditions in some ways, they don't have to take advantage of it. But for the tribes, particularly those in British Columbia, which have a great deal of political power in Canada, they are really trying to figure out ways that they can offer, get their people the kinds of freedoms that other people have. I visited, the Kamloops Band, and it's such an interesting contrast. You have on two sides of the river. One is regular Canadian British Columbia land, and the other land is what's called reserve land. That's what they call reservations there. Mm-hmm. And on the reserve land, you see great poverty, but you also see a lot of what's revealing about the property rights problem. There are temporary structures that are there. A lot of the land that is most valuable is simply being occupied by trailer homes. It's very hard when you don't have property rights to put any long-term investment into an area.
How would you compare Canada's laws and the motivation of Native Americans here in the U.S.?
I think they have a greater amount of political power simply because of the way natives are distributed there, which is to say that in certain provinces, they're actually carrying quite a bit of political power because of their numbers. In America, you have a few states, places like South Dakota or Arizona, where there's a significant Native population, but those states are, of course, a couple among the 50 states. And so I think that balance of power, the power structure that you see in Canada is not the same as here. And they also have very different, they have different treaties and different Supreme Court laws about this. But, as odd as it seems and as perhaps offensive as it seems to some people, I think that we can all agree that the system we have in place is simply not working today. And it's really time to rethink the way we have tried to protect the rights of Indians, because what we're doing is not working.
Naomi, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Naomi Schaefer Riley. She's author of a book called The New Trail of Tears, How Washington is Destroying American Indians. And she wrote about property rights on reservations for The Atlantic. You'll find a link to both at wordofmouthradio.org. In 2014, Southeast Asian cuisine was it. Malaysian, Filipino, Indonesian. Then it was Southern Mediterranean, then Peruvian. So at a time when simple, back-to-the-landish local food is decidedly on trend, why aren't Americans seizing on the country's truly local fare, Native American food? It's a question that Emily Durie looked into. She's Senior Associate Editor covering education for The Atlantic. Emily, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
So, as we said, several times over the past few years, food writers, bloggers, your magazine, The Atlantic, declared Native American cuisine as the next big thing. Why do you think it hasn't panned out?
They did declare that, and it makes sense. It's local and seems like it would catch on, but it really hasn't. And I think part of that is because people just don't really know what it is.
And what is it? What is Native American food?
That's another issue. It's really hard to define. So people have lots of different ideas. People will think about things like buffalo, but salmon can also be Native American. It completely depends on the tribe, and there are more than 500 tribes in the U.S. So the central theme is it's very local. So foraging is big, and relying on local crops and herds is key. There's a restaurant that's the subject of this piece in Denver called Tokabe, and Ben Jacobs, one of the owners, sees education as part of his mission. So he spends a lot of time, not necessarily on branding, but on educating the community and on talking to people who come into the restaurant. So not necessarily great for business, but he sees it as part of his mission to educate people.
Well, tell us a little bit more about Ben's entrepreneurial hopes for Tokabe.
So he partnered with one other man, and they decided, not quite a decade ago, that they were going to start this Native American restaurant. And Ben is part of the Osage tribe in Oklahoma, and he had grown up around restaurants. His parents owned restaurants, including one Native American restaurant. And he decided fast casual was the way to go.
Fast casual, would that compare with like a Chipotle or sort of Panera
exactly,
kind of thing?
Exactly. And Chipotle is frequently the comparison that's used because Chipotle was also sort of started in Denver.
Well, I think a lot of people have an association with Native American food with fry bread. This idea of fried food, very heavy, very dense. So they wouldn't think it's a healthy alternative.
Exactly. And Ben will say, you know, you shouldn't eat my food every day of the week the same way that you shouldn't have a hamburger and french fries every day of the week. But occasionally, it's okay. And he does start with fry bread, which is controversial. It was something that many tribes consider survival food, where they were uprooted from their communities and it was sort of what they were given by the government in order to survive. And not all Native Americans think that fry bread should be preserved, but it is something that is common among tribes. And so Ben felt it was a good place to start. So he uses it a bit the way Chipotle would use a tortilla. So you can have a fry bread taco, you can have kind of a salad on top of your fry bread, but it is pretty much the base of everything else at Tokabe. And then he looks to other ingredients. So they have buffalo, for instance. But that also brings up an issue of cost because buffalo is so much more expensive than beef. And he has to pass some of that cost along to the customers, and they're not always receptive to that because it is kind of a fast casual restaurant.
From my limited understanding of Native American culture, which of course there's a huge variety within the tribes, there's a sort of place in the cosmology for the food one eats. So is presenting Native American food in a kind of, you know, more fast food environment an anathema to the traditionalists?
In some ways, yes. And there was actually an interview with a Native American chef on NPR, and he basically said that restaurants aren't necessarily a part of Native culture, that that's not something that's common. And so in some ways, there are these really innovative Native American chefs, you know, probably across the country. We just don't know about it because they don't take their food into restaurants. They feel that it's more important to sort of stay with the tribe, to feed the tribe, to serve the tribe. And it's very much a communal thing. But it's not necessarily something that's shared widely.
So with chefs like Ben Jacobs, who have a larger mission to educate people, do we have any good models of, I don't know, education and food service at the same time. I mean, that's a lot to put on the success of a restaurant.
Right. It's complicated. And he started this very young. I mean, he was in his mid-20s when they opened Tokabe, and so was his business partner, Matt Chandra. And they really looked to serve the community from the outset, but it has been kind of an experiment. So he thinks, for instance, that it's really important to hire Native American workers. That's great, but a lot of them don't have restaurant experience, and he hires young people, so he might hire teenagers, and he spends a lot of time working with them. He also, and I thought this was interesting, he doesn't consider himself a chef, even though I would argue that he is. He sees his work as kind of preserving Native food, and he asks his workers to bring in family recipes, and they spend a lot of time kind of testing those out. He does all of these different things, and that takes a lot of time away from running the business. And he would argue it's part of the business, that is part of his mission, but it's certainly not something that you see most chefs devoting significant time to.
So what do you think it would take, Emily Derry? Maybe a celebrity chef, well-known, embracing Native American food to give it a little bit more luster in the public eye?
Potentially, I think that could help, but I think that it would also have to be done carefully, because you wouldn't want to give the impression that you were appropriating something that wasn't yours. And I think that Native communities are very proud of their food, but they also want to be the ones to preserve it and to share it, and sort of passing it off to someone else raises some questions, I think.
Emily Derry, she's Senior Associate Editor covering education for The Atlantic. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Her article in The Atlantic is called "Why Isn't Native American Food Hip?" You can find a link to read it at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. If you looked at maps that existed before Columbus arrived in the New World, you might assume that he was the first to discover the Americas, a claim disputed, by the way, by evidence of Viking explorers around the year 1000. Both accounts dismiss the fact that indigenous people had been living here long before they arrived. Although most of us were taught to think of maps as factual representations, the perspectives and biases of every cartographer is inherent in the documents they create. This next piece from the podcast Imaginary Worlds studies bias in maps, fantasy maps.
You're listening to Imaginary Worlds, a show about how we create them and why we suspend our disbelief. I'm Eric Molinsky. And this is Stefan Ekman. He's a professor at the University of Gothenburg in Sweden.
My family, or part of my family, come from Dresden in what was then southern East Germany.
When he was a kid, he'd visit his relatives in East Germany, which sounds so strange to me. I mean, as an American growing up in the Cold War, East Germany was like a forbidden realm behind the Iron Curtain. But Stefan didn't like going there because it was boring. And then he became even more bored.
I ended up in an East German hospital with appendicitis. I was 10. I did not speak German. And there was nothing for me to read, which was a major disaster. But my mother had brought along Lord of the Rings, which she'd failed to read for the umpteenth time. So that's what I read. And that's how I really got into the whole fantasy thing.
And by getting into the whole fantasy thing, he doesn't mean Dungeons and Dragons, although he actually does still play. Stefan is a scholar of J.R.R. Tolkien, and his real passion and focus are maps and fantasy worlds.
When you have maps, when you read map theory, there is always this idea that you want to represent the world in one way or another. But when you draw a fantasy map or any map of an imaginary world, that process is sort of turned on its head, because you could just decide that, no, I need mountains over here. And you realize that, okay, suddenly there are mountains there in the world.
He says maps are to the fantasy genre what science is to science fiction. The map is the thing that grounds you in the story and makes you believe this could be real. Now, Tolkien wasn't the first writer to map out a fantasy world. Back in the age of exploration, or as we know it now, colonization, maps were like this newfangled technology that everyone was excited about. And you can see that in many of the early fantasy novels.
If you look at something like Gulliver's Travels, which also came with maps that place very clearly the various countries, so Lilliput and Brobdingnag and the land of the Winnims, in relation to our world, trying to make the point that these sound fantastic, but they do exist. In fact, I think if I look at Brobdingnag, it should exist somewhere around or just north of San Francisco.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Now, Gulliver's Travels anchors the story in a recognizable Europe. The Wizard of Oz, of course, starts in Kansas. But Tolkien was creating a world from scratch. So it was really important for him to not only map out the distances that the characters would need to travel, but give everything a name.
You name the world, you control it by naming it, you create it, invent it by naming it.
The writer Ethan Gilsdorf says, if you look at the maps in L. Frank Baum's Wizard of Oz books or Dante's Inferno, they're simple, even whimsical. Tolkien's maps are much more serious.
Tolkien really, really used these maps as a creative tool, and they really weren't intended originally to be in his books. I mean, they really were just scribbles and drawings, and not only did he write maps, but he was a pretty accomplished artist, and I think as his world grew, he really felt like he needed something to keep track of it.
He was so precise, he would sketch out the maps and ask his son Christopher to do the final drawings, because he was the better draftsman.
You can look at some of these drafts of his maps of Middle-earth, and you realize that he's plotting them on graph paper, because he needs to know exactly how far things are down to the day because of the different converging plot lines of all the different characters.
Stefan says that these maps also reflect the psychology of Bilbo and Frodo, the hobbits that venture out beyond the safe but kind of dull Shire into the scary and exciting world of Middle-earth.
The roads and the road system really jumps out. This is a map about traveling and about journeys. You have little arrows pointing off the map saying there is a world out there.
And we don't even have to stick with the journey that the hobbits take. All we have to do is gaze at those maps and let our minds wander.
Normally, text tells you a story. You have a certain set of characters. With a map, you could leave the story and go outside it and explore the world. So the world wouldn't end when the story ended. It would still be there in one sense or another.
Tolkien really created a blueprint for how to approach fantasy maps. And if he has a literary heir, it's probably George R.R. Martin, the author of A Song of Ice and Fire, which, of course, inspired the HBO series Game of Thrones. Martin has been accused of emulating Tolkien a little too much. They even got into a fight about it.
Dragon's Dawn.
Or at least these guys did who are playing them in the YouTube series Epic Rap Battles of History.
You're a pirate. You even stole my RO. We all know the world is full of chance and anarchy. So yes, it's true to life for characters that die randomly. But newsflash, the genre's called fantasy. It's meant to be unrealistic, you myopic manatee.
Anyway, George R.R. Martin's world of Westeros does bear some resemblance to Middle-earth. But Martin never really got as into the map-making aspect. The fans of his books have actually gone way further in creating these interactive maps online that chart which families controlled which kingdoms or how the environmental landscape of Westeros has changed over thousands of years. I mean, the opening credits of Game of Thrones is a mesmerizing, interlocking 3D animated map that looks like it was made out of wood and metal. We really are living in a golden age of fantasy maps. I did an AMA on Reddit, which is like an online Q&A, and it was for a subgroup of world builders. And I was amazed at all the maps they were creating. And someone in the group told me that if I want to connect with the master of fantasy maps today, I should talk with Isaac Stewart.
In sixth grade, we read The Hobbit. Then the teacher asked us to make our own map and make our own story, and that was the coolest assignment ever. I don't remember anything else about sixth grade, but I remember making a map.
But you can't draw a straight line from sixth grade Isaac reading The Hobbit to his career today.
Right after high school, I went to college thinking I was going to be a dentist. That was really my dad's dream for me. There was a dental assistant there who said, oh, you want to be a dentist, huh? And I said, well, maybe, but you know, I was thinking about maybe going into art. And she said, oh, go into art. That's way better than this.
Isaac is best known for drawing maps for the novelist Brandon Sanderson. He is the author of the Mistborn series, and he's working on a 10-part series called the Stormlight Archives. Sanderson is so prolific, he is constantly keeping Isaac on his toes. Now, one of the things I like about Isaac's maps is that he doesn't make slight variations on land masses that we'd recognize from our world. He lets his imagination go wild in drawing islands or continents that could have been formed in really weird ways that are still totally believable. He also has a knack for emulating old parchment, making his maps look like artifacts that someone kept folded up in a satchel when they're traveling a great distance. And there's a design reason for that.
Doing a map for a fantasy novelist is I've got some limitations. It has to fit in either, you know, one or two pages on a book. I can't fill it out with hundreds and hundreds of names. You got to find this balance of the reader's going to flip here. You want them to find what they're looking for and then flip back to reading the book. I don't want my map to be a hindrance to reading the book.
I became so curious about the craft of fantasy map making. I asked if there's anyone else he'd recommend to chime in, and he said Priscilla Spencer.
She does this amazing, almost Romanesque map with little illustrations and drawings, and I think it's beautiful.
Oh my God, he knows who I am! Ah, that's so cool! I am a ridiculously huge fan of his work.
Actually, Priscilla was a professional fan before she was a professional map maker. What that means is she was a beta for the novelist Jim Butcher. He's best known for writing the Dresden Files. And the betas are an elite group of fans that writers like Butcher can rely on while he's working on rough drafts. And the betas kept asking to see a map of his Codex Alera series.
But unfortunately, he had lost his hand-drawn map in a move 2 years prior, and so he asked the betas for help, like, reconstructing the map that he'd been using for the first 4 books and had kind of been winging for the last two. So I stepped up and volunteered.
Now, Priscilla draws by hand, and then plays with the maps in Photoshop. And they look like treasured artifacts from these worlds, but partially it's because she embellishes them with very specific thematic design flourishes.
I feel like it's so much more fun when these maps tell you about the cultures that produce them. For the Cinder Spires series, which copper plays, it is kind of like the lifeblood of this world. Like it has a very kind of steampunky vibe. So I wanted this map to resemble like a copper plate etching.
Fantasy maps look deceptively simple because, you know, you can make up whatever you want. But Priscilla says when people start out in this field, they often make the same rookie mistakes.
The number one mistake is like making sure that there's a water source next to every city, whether it's an ocean, whether it's a river, like some place where these people can kind of sustain themselves.
You know, we just don't have a lot of examples of this in real life unless it's kind of artificially that way, like Las Vegas. You know, and still with Las Vegas, we're wondering where are they getting their water, and it's causing all sorts of problems.
Isaac feels that too many fantasy map makers aren't studying real geography.
Sometimes you'll see these rivers that seem to go through mountain ranges. So just knowing which way, how rivers flow, they follow gravity. They go from high places to low places. If you're going to do something that's out of the norm, you better have a good reason for it, or a magical reason. You know, and it's actually by making little mistakes like that, and then if you realize it, you might come up with some cool story ideas.
And after studying the real world, you have to study real maps. One of the things that really bugs him is when fantasy map makers don't give a lot of thought to how their borders are drawn.
If you look at the Holy Roman Empire, it looks like puzzle pieces because you've got so many different factions and families and political entities that are vying for power that they'll push their borders here or there, and the borders just change and they look all squirrely. But nowadays, kind of since modern times, empires will go in and they'll conquer a place. They'll redraw these kind of artificial borders in straight lines.
Many of our conflicts today come from borders that were drawn as straight lines by colonial powers, from people who had no understanding of the religious, social, or political factions in the lands they were cutting up.
Maps are time machines. We can look back in time and see how things have changed or not changed.
And fantasy map makers can do the same thing. Like when Priscilla drew her maps for Jim Butcher's Codex Alera series, she had to depict an alien world that was colonized by a Roman legion that got lost in space-time. The map, of course, was created by these intergalactic Romans.
Jim and I talked about it early on, and we envisioned it as being like a document created for students' reference in the Academy at Alera Imperia. So like it put a little bit more emphasis on the cities and kind of like how they serve this like monolithic, beautiful icon of Alera Imperia, the capital. This culture is very xenophobic. It's kind of constantly at war or like Cold War with the cultures that live to the west and to the east. The what they thought of as just savage wolfmen, like these tribespeople that have like bonded with these animals. Like they have these sort of totemic creatures that kind of bond with them and are with them for life. There are all these rumors that like there's like bestiality going on, and so like in the map I have this female Marat is kind of like reaching back and touching her like terror bird totem in a way that like I'm not saying that they're having some sort of illicit gross thing, but like if you want to infer that from the illustration, go ahead.
Aside from the implied bestiality, that map actually reminded me of a map that I used to stare at when I was in seventh grade. It was a rectangular map on the wall of my social studies class. The USA was smack dab in the middle. The Soviet Empire, including East Germany, where Stefan Ekman used to go as a kid, was split in half. Each end of the Soviet Union jutted out of the right and left side of the map. Today that sounds ridiculous, but in 1984, it felt right to me. And it's funny because today I think about like Google Maps, which to me is a beautifully designed, perfectly accurate representation of the world around me. But it is also full of biases that will be more and more obvious to future generations. The act of creating a map is an act of creation. It's an act of creativity. And the great thing about fantasy maps is that they remind us that every map tells a story, whether it means to or not.
Our thanks to Eric Malinsky and the podcast Imaginary Worlds for that story. Even before Hurricane Matthew made landfall, the storm was making news. It has been one of the fastest growing and longest lived storms on record, and it comes unseasonably late, leading to discussions of whether Matthew could be another sign of a changing climate and more evidence that extreme weather events are no longer confined to a specific season or geographical area. As far as the historical record goes, only a handful of hurricanes have come as far north as New Hampshire, and none compared to the hurricane of 1938. The storm made landfall in Long Island and then carved a path of destruction north through Connecticut, Massachusetts, Vermont, and New Hampshire. Hundreds of people were killed, and damages were in the billions of dollars. What really took the brunt was New England's forests. Stephen Long is founder and former editor of Northern Woodlands magazine. We spoke to him when his book, 38, The Hurricane That Transformed New England, first came out.
Well, we've never seen anything like it. I mean, we have had hurricanes that have come up into this area, but by the time they've reached here, they've lost all of their wind. So we had tremendous flooding from Irene. It was really a terrible, terrible storm, particularly in Vermont. But it was all rain. It was a slow-moving storm that dumped a whole bunch of rain. 38 was a hurricane that came up on a northern path all the way into New Hampshire and Vermont and brought 100-mile-an-hour winds to this area. I mean, we've never seen 100-mile-an-hour winds. And that followed a weather system that had been here for a week or so, and it had dumped 3, 4, 5, 6 inches of rain. So totally unrelated to the hurricane, there was flooding conditions already on the ground. And so if the hurricane had never come through, the event would have been known as the flood of 1938. But 100-mile-an-hour winds is unprecedented.
Well, today we have inventories, we have modeling that shows us, at least to some degree, what kind of damage a big storm could do if it hit us. But back in 1938, New Englanders had no concept of what a powerful storm could do. What did that mean and how it all played out?
Now, you know, when the late summer, early fall comes around, we're all sort of watching the Weather Channel. If we hear that there's a storm coming, a hurricane coming, we prepare for it. But the 38 hurricane was absolutely a stunning event that no one had the slightest idea was even a possibility. There had been a generation or two had gone by since the last hurricane hit New England. And so the Boston Globe, the next morning after the hurricane hit, called it New England's first hurricane. Now, that's amazing to us to think that there could have been a time when we were not aware that hurricanes could hit here. But and I'm talking about not just up here, but down on the coast. The coast had not experienced a hurricane for about 60 or 70 years.
So they had no record. The cost to infrastructure was then about $300 million, $5 billion in today's money. How much damage did New Hampshire's forests endure?
New Hampshire's forests were particularly hard hit. Out of the 2.6 billion board feet that went down, a great percentage of it was in New Hampshire. New Hampshire was in a particularly vulnerable situation right then because it had a lot of white pine throughout the state, and white pine was particularly vulnerable. It was tall enough at that time. The economy, we were in the midst of the Depression. The 20s weren't any kinder to the forest-based economy. And so trees had considerable time to grow, and they were tall, and they went down everywhere the wind blew. What happened, interestingly enough, was this hurricane, this tremendous devastation, actually ended up breathing new life into the forest products industry.
Yeah, I'd love to know more about that. But first, just want to picture, you say 2.6 billion board feet of wood. Now, what does that look like?
Sure. If you've been out on an interstate behind a log truck, you're following 6,000 board feet. And so if you make almost 500,000 of those trucks, picture that, and that's what blew down.
You also point out that it would take New England's biggest sawmill operating today 29 years to process that much lumber.
That's right.
So, yeah. So if you're taking a walk in a New Hampshire forest today, can you see the remnants of the 38 hurricane in the landscape?
Oh, sure. Yeah, there's signs of it everywhere. The most obvious sign would be what's called pit and mound topography. And what that is when a tree blows over, its roots rip out of the ground the soil and the rocks, and it creates a hole. And then over time, as the wood of the root system disintegrates, it creates a mound. And so if you see a preponderance of this pit and mound topography, you can pretty much guarantee that it was the hurricane. And one way of being absolutely certain is to look at the direction. So if you stand in the pit and look out over the mound, you should be looking somewhere to the north or northwest. And in that case, that means that the wind was behind you, south or southeast, and that was the wind that did all the damage.
We're talking about the devastating hurricane that hit New England in 1938 and felled 2.6 billion board feet of timber, an awful lot, by the way, and caused approximately $5 billion of today's dollars in damage. Stephen Long is with us. He's the author of 38. How did the felling of all this lumber reverberate throughout the New England economy at the time? Like, who suffered from that? Who benefited from all of this wood?
Well, it was an unprecedented amount of wood on the ground. Throughout New England, it represented five times the amount of the annual harvest. without any action taken by the government, people would have really been in a terrible bind because there's this glut of wood on the ground. And people who had counted on this as their savings bank were in great jeopardy. So what happened was the U.S. Forest Service and the WPA and CCC came in as part of the Northeast Timber Salvage Administration. The government set up a program, A, to clean up the brush, because people were really...
Right, the real danger of forest fires.
Very, very frightened about forest fires. And B, set up a system by which they would buy delivered wood, delivered logs. And then by doing that, there was a need for sawmills to saw the wood into lumber. There was a need for loggers to bring the wood to the mills. And so it was actually quite a boon to people in a situation where there was great, great possibility for what would have been a total loss.
So sawmills were set up everywhere. And this is thanks to the federal government in this case, you know, part of Roosevelt's alphabet soup, as they call it, all of these federal agencies that came together. What do you think the response would be today if a hurricane of that magnitude struck New England? How would things be different? How would it manifest today?
Well, things would be terribly different for a number of reasons. One, there's almost twice the number of people living in the stricken area as there were. There was about 9 million people in the area. Now there's 17 million. So many, many more people would be affected. There's the forests themselves are more mature. There, more area is covered with forest, particularly in Vermont. Vermont was at that time probably 45% forested. Now it's 80%. New Hampshire's 80-85%. So there would be more mature trees ready to blow down. There's so much more infrastructure in place. All the roads, everything would be covered just like it was back then. But there would be much less likelihood that the federal government would step in the way that they did at the time. Another sort of a similarity to that time is that the forest products industry at this time is they're probably harvesting the same amount of wood they were 10 or 15 years ago, but that's being done by fewer people. So the companies are larger and there are fewer loggers out there doing this work. So if you have this time around, instead of 30,000 landowners in jeopardy, this time around you have more like 100,000, there aren't 100,000 loggers, and they're just not going to appear in time to get this done. So it'll probably be more of a situation where people are having to pay to have this work done. No one's going to be made whole unless they already have a good relationship with a logger who can get to their land and take care of it.
Decimated forests, new federal programs, sawmills all over the countryside, all in the Depression era, and this is pre-World War II America. What do you think, Stephen Long, the legacy of the 38 hurricane was on the character of New England and its citizens?
Well, the way that people came together in a private-public partnership, I think, was quite a rallying event for people. So they turned devastation into a success story in a lot of ways. I think that people ended up feeling like they'd turned lemons into lemonade and had survived something totally unprecedented.
Stephen Long, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you so much.
Stephen Long, he's founder and former editor of Northern Woodlands magazine. His book is called 38, The Hurricane That Transformed New England. Thank you for spending some time with us on your Columbus Day holiday. Music in this episode came to us from D-Lay, David Sestay, Jason Leonard, and Blue Dot Sessions. There's a lot more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org, and you can listen to the show on your own time with the Word of Mouth podcast. Just search Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes or Google Play. And please leave a rating, which will help other people find it when shared by Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, back tomorrow at 2, right here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue, Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.